I was really happy to hear about the organization of this conference. Thank you, Claire. It doesn't surprise me that it happens in the UK first. I hope it'll happen in the States pretty soon. I met Andrea this month 32 years ago. It was 1974. I fell in love with her pretty fast. By June of that year, we had decided to live together. And on August 1, 1974, we began living together. Although my talk is about what she knew about her work, it might cross-reference with what I knew about her work. And I was looking at a book I gave her in December of that year. It was a three-volume biographical dictionary of notable American women up to 1950. And I opened and found this inscription, kind of to my surprise. Mind you, I'd known her less than a year. "To Andrea, in confidence that your life and work..." I'm taking baby steps with this. Give me a moment. "To Andrea, in confidence that your life and work will inform the next edition of this book, and with love, John." Pretty early on, I figured out that she was a really great writer. She had written Woman Hating. I read it in a tear. It changed my life. That passage that Valerie read about, "We're a multi-sex species," completely liberated me. And I made it a kind of decision that my life work at that point was going to be to make sure that she did hers. And a lot of the choices that were made over the next 30 years turned on that. And as you see, I'm here now having made another choice to be a resource for her legacy. The reason for this title of this talk kind of came out of a conversation that Andrew and I had once. It was about the book of her Scapegoat, which is this magnum opus called, and the subtitle is Women, the Jews, Women, Israel, the Jews, and Women's Liberation. I know I'm getting this wrong. And I know that many of your readings of Andrea will be better recollected than mine, even though I saw about 99% of what she wrote before it went out into the world. That doesn't mean I remember it all. We were talking about Scapegoat. I had been reading it chapter by chapter, as I did everything she did, and as she wrote, as she read and commented on everything I did. And at a certain point, I asked her why she hadn't clarified in an introduction somewhere that there was a real new method being invented in this book. She had reclaimed the argument about the relationship between race and racism and sexism from the kind of siloed way of thinking about that, and had found this extraordinarily new nexus, theoretically, philosophically, between race hate and woman hate in that book. And I said, "Why don't you say that's what you're doing?" And she didn't disagree that that's what she was doing. She just said, "I'm not that kind of a writer." And she wasn't. She wasn't that kind of a writer who would say, "Now I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to tell it to you, and now I'm going to tell you what I just told you." She didn't write that way. That book was, you know, has been, what has been noticed in that book is the way in which she found in the situation of the State of Israel kind of metaphor for the need for women to be fully, for a right to embodiment, for entitlement to integrity, to self-defense. And she overlaid women's bodies with the State of Israel in a very rich and complex literary way to say women have a right to exist as human beings. Woven through that book is this other thing about race hate and woman hate that's just extraordinary, and I've seen no critics pay any attention to it. And it's not as if she gave them any tip-off either. But it's there. So that was kind of the reason I wanted to bring to this room something about what she knew about her work that she often didn't put in her work. She's written a lot about writing. I remember in the early days of our relationship, She sent something off, I can't remember what it was, to the feminist press, which was a press in New York. And they sent it back to her, and they said, "You write like a man. When you learn to write like a woman, we'll publish you." And I thought about this several weeks ago. I was walking around in the apartment where we lived in Washington, D.C. We moved from New York to Washington in late 2003, early 2004, bringing along over 600 shelf feet of books. I know because I measured them and figured out where they go and how they would be categorized and how to tell the movers where they went. And our library was organized by gender. We had all male nonfiction in one place and all female nonfiction in another. We had all male biography in another, all female biography in another, and so on and so forth. All fiction, her bedroom was lined with bookcases full of male fiction. In our dining room was a vast collection of biographies of men. And I just stood there a moment before coming here and jotted down some of their names. Genet, Che, Rodin, Orwell, two of them, Martin Luther King, three of them, Rimbaud, Zola, Verdi, Primo Levi, Keats, Dickens, Darwin, Brecht, Beckett, Camus, Mozart, Mahler, Strindberg, Tolstoy, Yeats, three of them, Keats. Now, in the other room were, you know, biographies of women, two of George Eliot, five of Colette, the Brontes, and so forth. But I've always been amazed at how much she read in of the lives of great men. She was a voracious reader, as you know. You look at the biographies, the bibliographies in her book, hundreds of books. She read them all. And she didn't put anything into a bibliography that she didn't read the whole thing. And there's this vast library of the lives of great men. And I kind of always wondered, why is she doing this? Why? And we had some conversations about it, because I know she would let me know now and then how she was forming this impression that these lives all ended pretty badly and unhappily in general. And I finally figured out that I think she was just trying to figure out how they did it. How do you live as with this kind of sense of one's place in the world? And she was looking for clues, I believe, from a lot of great men. And it didn't surprise me. It was the kind of fierce and intellect that she had. But as I say, I think it would surprise a lot of people that she was so into men in this way. The fact that they ended badly, these lives, and she always kind of wrote about how survival is really random and that there would be some blow that would just knock her out. In a sense, there was the date rape in Paris, about which more later. But she really wanted to be a writer who made the world a better place. And she saw her work, as many have said here, as a kind of mission. And it's not as if it was unrelated to what others were doing, but she knew that she was doing something that no one else was really doing the way she was really doing it. And I don't know if she knew for sure that it would be noticed as such. I don't know if she knew for sure that it would survive her. But I think she had a pretty good idea that it wasn't going to be until after she died that people would really understand what she'd been doing all those years. I'm going to talk about what she knew about her work in relationship to just a few topics. They're in no particular order, and they're not exactly random, but they haven't really been talked about yet here, so I thought I'd just toss off some thoughts. One is about her, what she knew about her work in relationship to literature. Excuse me. As you know, if you've read the books that are drawn from literature, pornography, intercourse, scapegoat, the one she was working on when she died, which was called Writing America, which was an analysis of eight major American writers and how they created a gendered American identity. I think a lot of friends of hers, and I was too, were welcomed the fact that she was taking on a project that didn't involve a total immersion in atrocity, which took a toll. She went into pornography and read it, and it kept coming to the house, and like toxic stuff, and she was studying it. It became the literature that she wrote that book about. And mind you, that book, Pornography, was written before there was a glimmer in her eye about a legal remedy for it. It really is a kind of, well, she always rejected the term literary criticism, but it is a kind of criticism of the literature of pornography, finding out what it means. What does it mean to women? What does it mean about our world? What does it mean about men and women? And she did the same thing, I think, even to more profound effect in intercourse. All of that is, she's reading Tolstoy, she's reading, her chapter about communion in sex is all about anal intercourse in the work of James Baldwin. It's the most amazing chapter. Her book about skinlessness, which I confess is probably beyond my experience, my ability to experience, is all about the work of Kobo Abe, this Japanese writer. You look at that book, and it's writer after writer after writer, and she believed in literature as primary source material. And I think that is something that gets missed a lot when she's talked about as a theoretician or as an activist and so on and so forth. She really believed her work had a place in the world of literature, and she really believed the world of literature spoke to her in a way that she was going to try to reveal to people. I think she may have been put on this trail by the influence of the book Sexual Politics by Kate Millett, which was written in this with this method as well, although it didn't go into depth about sexual violence as such, the way Andrew's work began to do. Another topic, just kind of floating out there. These are kind of notes for, I don't know, a chapter in a book I might write someday, okay? I'm just warming up. She knew something about her work in relationship to language and music, and I put those two together into the same category. She had, if you know anything about her writing method, when I met her, she was using a manual typewriter and then switched over to an electric, and she would type a page over and over again, as many as 10 times, and each time she retyped it, she would rewrite it a little bit. This is way before word processing, but it was an extraordinary way of going deep inside the pulsing rhythm of a text. She really wrote raw, as you know, a lot of the time. But to get to that raw marrow of experience, she really, really had an enormous discipline about that. And she always had music on while she wrote. Classical, country. She really did believe deeply in the relationship of language and music in her work. It's a commonplace of editing, and I know because I am an editor, that you're supposed to not use repetition. If there's a repeating word even in the same paragraph, you're supposed to change it. Andrea used repetition the way great musicians use theme and variation. And the way in which themes wove around in her various works had a fundamental music structure to it. She eschewed the linear, as you know. I mean, the forms of her books were more like helixes. I mean, they were more like gathering vortexes or tornadoes, gathering more and more energy into a point of impact in the gut. So I just wanted to say something about that. Another topic here, Andrea's work in relationship to politics left and right in the United States. I saw once a kind of a diagram of recent books that have been published that had done well. There were the red books, the conservative books, and the blue books, the liberal books, and it showed how books that were really selling well by public intellectuals, they gathered in one camp or another, and publishers knew this. Well, I looked at that and I thought, Andrea can't be in that chart. She doesn't fit either place. She was anathematized by both. She was also revered in various ways by both. After she died, as you know, there's all kinds of stuff in the international press, but one of the things that people in some press in the States picked up on is that there were kind of tributes from right conservative commentators. Don't know if they mean anything here. David Frum, Christopher Hitchens, Maggie Gallagher. You probably have equivalents here. And Andrea knew that her work was being read by people who would be considered conservative, as well as by people who were considered liberal and the left. She had, as you know, a very stressed relationship with the left. It came out. She had a real break with the left when she started writing woman-hating and started critiquing this pornography magazine called Suck that she and her friends were all involved with. So she was at a remove from both, and in a way that radical feminism is at a remove from both politics, left and right. And she knew that about her book, and she knew she was read by very smart people, left and right, and she knew she was hated, both left and right. And it didn't really faze her, except that, of course, it meant a curtailment of her publishing opportunity, because publishers had this bandwagon, the red version and the blue version, and she didn't write either one. I'm going to say something about money and something about men and something about her life. As regards money, there are books that she was determined to do whether a publisher understood it and wanted to buy it or not. And Scapegoat was one. She persevered with that. It took her 9 years to write that book. And she didn't have a contract for it until well into those 9 years. The book she was writing when she died and was still reading and taking notes on in her reading chair didn't have a publisher. There was a book that was being talked about to a couple of editors by her agent. It was a book about Lydia England, the private Lydia England, the woman in the photograph from Abu Ghraib. She was going to write that book if a contract was offered to her, but the one that was closer to her heart was the book that she was determined to write, whether a publisher came around or not. And pornography was that kind of a book as well. It did find a publisher. To her regret, I believe, the second volume of that book was never published. It was never written, actually, because the publisher, after she got the first volume done, basically gave her no option but to go to press with that book and without a contract to write the second book. And I think she always felt that she never really made the case fully that she intended to make. There's a missing second volume to that book that she had plotted but didn't write. I think my point is about her work in relationship to money. There were a few things she did because the money was available to do them. I think she wouldn't have probably sat down to write a memoir if it hadn't been part of a two-book deal, and it was a way to get Scapegoat published. To get the publisher to buy Scapegoat, the publisher was offered, a memoir by Andrea Dworkin. That seemed like a real saleable thing, so the fact that it got together... No, they're both fine books, but I don't think she would have sat down at that age yet to write a memoir. I'm glad she did. I'm glad it's here. I think she knew that her work had the power to change and save women's lives almost in inverse proportion to its commercial value and worth. The readers who were so profoundly touched and moved by it were not necessarily people who acquired books. And about men, she also knew that her works were really read deeply by men. And some of the men she knew, some of the men who wrote her, who talked to her when she was out speaking, she knew. She knew there were men who read her deeply. And I would sometimes kind of look at her work and see, how is she aware of that readership? And there's a sense in which she didn't do that thing that popular magazine editors insist that you do, which is to drop in the word some in front of the word men. You can't, you just can't say men unless you say some men. She didn't do it with women either. And this from the person who believed that the polar sex, the ideas of two polar sex identities were a cultural fiction. But when she wrote, when she went to the marrow of the way the world works, she said women and she said men, and she knew that the women who needed to know that there was someone who was totally in solidarity with them were going to get it, and she knew that the men who knew that there were men out there like that, even if they were trying to exempt themselves, they knew it was not untrue, and they didn't need the some word in there in order to get the meaning of the sentence, because they've seen men be fuckers. They knew it. She gave voice to that. She gave voice to that discontent in men about other men. And she, I know, helped a lot of men see their place in the world. And the possibility of being an ally. There was a piece she wrote called I Want a 24-Hour Truce During Which There Is No Rape. It inspired dozens of men, anti-rape groups across the U.S. It was republished in a book, I think it's in Letters from a War Zone. It's a very influential piece. People keep reading it and reading it and reading. I went to a college day where everyone was wearing T-shirts, 24-Hour Truce T-shirts. So, I mean, she had an enormous effect on male activism against men's violence in the United States. People have asked me, where did her strength come from? Because she really was very strong. And in a kind of character strength and also determination in relationship to her writing. And she really was an advocate for women. She really was an uncompromisingly in solidarity with women. And I've been thinking about the ways in which there are other moral leaders of other constituencies of people, revolutionary leaders who have been not just spokespeople for the group of people with whom they're in solidarity, but like moral forerunners, really brave in their single-minded conviction that what was happening to their people had to stop because it was wrong. You could think of Malcolm X or Gandhi or other people who have based their convictions in solidarity with the group of people to which they were, into which they were cast when they were oppressed and with whom they kept faith throughout their lives. And Andrew's strength, I believe, came from that. I don't think it was received in some other way. I think that once she made that vow early in her life to use what she knew from what had happened to her for women, that just locked her into a kind of strength reservoir that served her through most of her life. And so you can't, in the way you can't ask where did the strength of those other kinds of leaders come from, you can't really ask it of Andrea. And I don't mean to be, you know, hyperbolic, but I think structurally it's the same kind of a life. That was the person I knew. I think that was what was going on. I mean, I could be by turns in awe of it and just like, oh, that's the everyday Andrea. But I really think that was the outline of her life. And the strength that came from the people with whom she made the contract, the people called women, it was because she was of them, and it was so strong that even when women were being shits to her, she was in solidarity with people called women. When she, that was harder on me to watch women be shits to her. It kind of messed with my whole idea of what feminism was. But I kind of learned, yeah, that's what happens. When you have that uncompromising solidarity with women, other women don't like it. It becomes a rebuke. It becomes a chastisement. It reminds them of their own deal made with male supremacy in a way that they cannot tolerate. And so they take it out on the one who reminded them of that. Yeah? This, her entire body of work was driven by this love of women. And I think any reader can tap into that. I think one of the reasons women return to it, and especially the book stuff, obviously the speeches and obviously the articles and that kind of thing too, but the stuff that she wrote when she was at her typewriter, typing and retyping and retyping, finding that language for the raw experience. I do believe that when one taps into that, one can be reminded of what it is like to have an uncompromised solidarity with women. And I think we live in a world where that solidarity is really despised. I think everybody has to cut a deal somewhere along the line to sell out women. I think that's how little boys learn to be men. I think they learn the point at which they have to make the deal and sell out, make the joke, laugh at the joke, dismiss, mock. I think there isn't a point in a woman's career when she cannot, if it's in a career where men make decisions, I don't think there's a point in any woman's career where she isn't faced at some point with that juncture where she has to say, I'm not one of the cunts. I'm exceptional. I'm a queen. I think it happens to every woman. I think it had to happen. I think Andrea knew what that was like to walk up to that point. I think she knew it from having been prostituted. I think she knew it from other points in her publishing career. I don't think she was alone in having experienced that juncture. But I think she was really someone who said with her whole life, no, not this life, not this person. I don't cut a deal. And I think that courage, and that's what her name means, courage, Andrew. I think that courage is available to anyone who goes back into the work and reads those words, which are still alive. Thank you.